So on Monday, I finished my talk describing the three archetypal bodies of the Buddha, which represent the three fundamental aspects of reality. There's the pure and clear Dharmakaya, vast emptiness, the infinite blue sky, yet pregnant with possibility. And there's the full and complete Sambhogakaya, with each abiding in his, her, or its own unique and dynamic Dharma position. And next, the infinitely varied Dharmakaya. All of us inter are, as Thich Nhat Hanh is fond of saying. Or, this is independency, as Suzuki Roshi once called it. We're all in this together, and there is no way to escape. Monday I said, as we step into this world of snakes eating frogs and our response to that, we might want guidelines to help us assess our own behaviors, both internal and external. I suggested we hold the three-body construct up like a mirror to see and to feel if there were a resonance or congruence between our activities and internal dispositions and our practice values and precepts. Today I'll continue and finish with the Nirmanakaya and the Dharmakaya. As I just said, the Nirmanakaya is infinitely varied. There is a dependent origination, or to use a Western term with a different, more positive shading, it is codependency. Each relying on the other, connected at the hip. Lately in the new field of neuropsychology, the neuropsychologists are using machines that have scanning abilities of the mind and the pathways, the synapses running through that brain. And they've had some interesting insights. In one study, researchers have hooked up a psychotherapy client and a psychologist to two small machines that scan the neurological firings and pathways. And the researchers are able to watch in real time, these two brain firings. And as the client drops into a place of grief or sadness or some other aspect of suffering, a particular part of the brain is ignited. In a relatively short time, the psychologist's brain begins to show the same exact firing patterns. There is a replicated felt sense. The client and the therapist, I suppose you could say, inter are. There's much research going on in this field, and all of the findings are quite exciting. And many of them support some of the basic tenets of Zen and of Buddhism. However, all connections are not necessarily of the one-to-one kind. A monk asked the priests, Kan Feng, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to nirvana. I wonder, where is that road? Kan Feng lifted up his staff, drew a line in the air, and said, here it is. So this can be thought of as a one-to-one relationship. Later, a monk asked Yunmen about this. Yunmen held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the heaven of the 33rd and strikes the nose of the deity Sakra Devindra. Give a carp of the eastern sea one blow, and the rain comes down in torrents." This can be said to be not a one-to-one relationship. It's multidirectional, transcending our limited knowledge of time and space and its myriad relationships. Our actions can be in harmony, or they can be disharmonious. This is why in Sesshin, we always turn to the right. It's why we walk clockwise. We're following the path of the sun and of the moon and of the stars. We're moving with and in the natural flow. Of course, we can walk the other way, but it makes things more difficult. But to be harmonious doesn't mean to walk in step, to walk lockstep within a dysfunctional family or a dysfunctional workplace or in a dysfunctional nation state. Those are disharmonious situations which end in ruin because they're already walking against. When we walk in a natural direction, the gulls cry, the bells chime, and the tugboat's horn blast all join us in the Kinhin line, keeping the correct spacing. We do not walk alone, and we certainly never sit alone. This is the net of Indra, each a glistening jewel held by gossamer thread. When one sparkles, the others naturally absorb and then reflect like a twirling desert night sky. I have a daughter named Naomi who is 17 years old. Actually, I should put this thing off, too, right now, but she won't like to hear some of this, I think. She's often of a quite tempestuous autumn season, and our house can sometimes feel like southern Florida in that season. There are strong winds and soaking rains, and there are many times of lightning and great bursts of thunder. I think there are some reasons for her tempestuous behavior, for that type of character, and I can understand some of them. Autumn is always the time of school starting and the beginning of hard coursework. There's also varsity soccer, which brings her home way too late, many evenings. And then on the nights when there's not soccer, there's marching band. And then also, she's just being an under-rested social teenager. And then there's other reasons of her character that make her tempestuous, but I don't know anything about those. Anyway, over the years, she has taken to disliking the current president. For some reasons that she and I share, but for many reasons that are hers alone. Lately, she has been saying that if she is going to be tempestuous, attacking, offensive, and explosive, then her right to criticize Bush's foreign policy is less credible. I think her intuitive hunch is correct. She is noticing that her reckless behavior mirrors his. And Naomi hasn't said this, but I am now. That her behavior is simply a microcosm of his macrocosm and supports his disharmony. Working at the family kitchen, tending a sick horse, caring for a baby, arranging flowers for the altar, cleaning the bathrooms, and reading poetry aloud. That interrupts his disharmony. And all of those behaviors, tending, caring for, arranging, reading aloud, all of those shed light, and each of us glistens the more because of it. The jeweled necklace, the necklace of Indra, shines and glitters, and it can never be dampened, darkened, or extinguished. We can go against the Tao. We can go against the flow, and yet the necklace still dances in light. Or we can go with it, and it delights in the dance. The choice is ours, but the effect ultimately is the same. And this is the great mystery of life. The great mystery of death. No matter what we do, the light still sparkles, the necklace still shines and glitters. And that mystery is our joy. And that mystery, even when in the mouth of a snake, is our reason to celebrate. But if what we do doesn't matter, the necklace will still glitter. Why do anything at all? When you go against yourself or go against the Tao, the net of Indra still glistens, but your own glitter remains hidden below anxiety, worry, and fear. Or maybe this is a different way of saying it is like looking at the bejeweled blackened night through haze or through mist or clouds. The night sky still dances, but your eyes are too clouded over to notice and take part in the celebratory side of that dance. Now the Dharmakaya, that's the circle of wonder. It is pure and clear and pregnant with possibility. The Heart Sutra describes it this way: not born, not destroyed, not stained, not pure, without loss, without gain. No form, no sensation, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. And there is no suffering. There is no cause of suffering. There is no cessation and no path. There is obviously no need to save all beings because there are none. The mountains have been leveled and the valleys filled, so the field is leveled. This is a beautiful experience. There are no anxieties, no worries, and no constraints. And the void hums with energy, the energy of pregnancy. This is the experience of vast spaciousness with nothing holy. Compared to it, heaven and earth are narrow, and the sun, moon, and stars go dark next to its brilliance. It is before words and before activity, before thoughts and before duality. It is even before God. It can't be explained thoroughly or entirely shown. It is the original dwelling place where all things come completely to rest. But still, it has a sense of dynamic and creative possibility, and it is not transcendent and static, but charged, always charged, pregnant, but utterly relaxed. This is the eighth picture in the ox herding sequence. In some traditions and many practitioners, stop. It is a powerfully seductive and alluring experience. And many koan warn us about becoming too mesmerized or too entranced with that state of mind, because really, it has no power for the way. When one becomes entranced or mesmerized, addicted to this emptiness, we call it a Zen sickness. It's the sickness of complacency and passivity. And the words like go, the words go with complacency and passivity are, oh, it doesn't matter, it's all empty. Oh, there's nothing special at all, it's all one. And other such drivel. And the other side, the other sickness part, is nihilism. The sense that nothing matters, that there is no point. And if I did something, I would just be creating more karma, so why bother? This has been an ancient struggle for practitioners and for religions to move on past that vast, nothing holy. I wanted to read you a poem, just a paragraph that Merwin has here in his book called Migrations. It sort of raises this point and then resolves it. Every time they assembled and he spoke to them about waking, there was an old man who stood listening and left before the others. Until one day the old man stayed. And who are you? He asked the old man, and the old man answered, I am not a man. Many lives ago I stood where you are standing, and they assembled in front of me, and I spoke to them. I spoke to them about waking, until one day one of them asked me, when someone has wakened to what is really there, is that person free of the chain of consequences? And I answered, yes. And with that, I turned into a fox. And I have been a fox for 500 lives. And now I have come to ask you to say, what will free me from the body of a fox? Please tell me, when someone has awakened to what is really there, is that person free of the chain of consequences? And this time the answer was, That person sees it as it is. Then the old man said, "Thank you for waking me. You have set me free of the body of the fox, which you will find on the other side of the mountain. I ask you to bury it, please, as one of your own." That evening he announced a funeral service for one of them. But they said, "Nobody has died." Then he led them to the other side of the mountain in a cave where they found a fox's body. And he told them the story, and they buried the fox as one of them. But later, one of them asked, "What if he had given the right answer every time?" The Dharmakaya is Shakyamuni Buddha under the Bodhi tree before he stepped forward. But then the other aspects of the body arrived, or he was informed by them. So he got up to find his friends, and he began turning the great wheel of the dragon, teaching that all beings are the Tathagata, but their delusions and preoccupations keep them from touching that fact. Life and death and no life and death, self and no self, place and no place, form and emptiness, karma and essential only seem separate. But in fact, they are utterly entangled and fortunately entangling. When we hold this Dharmakaya mirror up to our activities and internal dispositions, what would be resonant or congruent with the experiential body would be openness and a spaciousness. There would be a warm vulnerability and an open-handedness. We would not grasp at or onto things or onto people or onto our own ideas and feelings. There would be a confidence, a joy even, in simply not knowing. Not knowing is an attitude or entranceway to our wandering, into the circle of wonder. I'm going to end this with just a really short poem by Musō Sasaki. It's called Withered Zen. The first part is about the Dharmakaya, and then the last three sentences, or the last three lines, are about the embodiment of the three bodies of the Buddha. He writes, "Both sacred wisdom and ordinary feeling have completely fallen away. No craving for success and fame rises in my mind. Don't tell me that I've fallen into the cave on Stone Frost Mountain. Inside my heart, I keep 3,000 prancing chestnut horses." And these horses' thundering hooves are the hooves of the Buddha's archetypal body. Those hooves are the hooves of your body and of my body, thundering, making a difference in this world. So I'll just stop right there. Okay, thank you.